Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, August 12th, 2006. This past week, we saw the 61st anniversaries of the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, go by. With that in mind, today we bring you two talks about confronting nuclear proliferation. Here's our plan for today. Our first hour will start off with Jim Terrell's World Report, looking at news and analysis. We'll then hear a KSOW interview of Cindy Sheehan while she was in Jordan about a week ago, and then we'll have the first of the series on confronting nuclear proliferation. In our second half, we'll start by hearing about the Mayors for Peace anti-nuclear campaign. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. This week's Between the Lines features a progressive Jewish group pushing for just settlement of Middle East conflict, military sources saying the U.S. has sent cruise missile first attack team to Israel, and the government industry effort to revive nuclear power. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, in place of our usual news segment, we bring you Jim Terrell's World Report. This week it's entitled Giant Steps Toward New Balance of Power, the U.S. in a Multipolar World.
Is the U.S. still the world's only superpower? And what does that mean, anyway? The U.S. is certainly not the only country to be motivated by national grandeur, ideological fulfillment, religious messianism, economic aggrandizement, regional domination, or global standing. France, Germany, Russia, China and India come to mind, Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela. Even Canada has developed a sudden interest in projecting power, although the reasons why are still in the undisclosed part of the Harper agenda. Huntington describes the U.S. as the only superpower with overwhelming dominance in virtually every category of power, whether it's military, economic, technological, cultural, diplomatic, or what have you. But U.S. dominance has taken several big hits in the last few weeks, mostly in the areas of diplomacy, trade, and politics, while the lesson that military might cannot do it all continues to be ongoing. After the Rome summit on Lebanon failed to produce anything but an Israeli declaration that no action was as good as a green light, the New York Times on July 25th accused Condoleezza Rice of foot-dragging and called the pledge of humanitarian aid, quote, much too little and extremely late, end quote. Just as a point of reference, the Israeli soldiers were captured on July 12th and the Beirut airport bombed on the 13th. Rice arrived in the Middle East 10 days later on the 23rd. Then France and Iran stepped into the diplomatic vacuum after the Qana bombing on the 30th, with visits to Beirut by their foreign ministers when Lebanon told the Secretary of State they had canceled her visit. France does not list Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, while Israel continued to treat diplomacy as a last resort, and the United States criticized Iran for supporting Hezbollah, Mr. Philippe Douste-Blazy, the French foreign minister, said Iran could play a, quote, stabilizing role, end quote, in the Middle East. Meanwhile, Mark Malik Brown, a British diplomat promoted this year to Deputy Secretary General of the UN, provoked one U.S. spokesman to anger when he told the Financial Times that Bush and Blair should, quote, know not just when to lead, but when to follow, allowing France, among others, to share the lead, end quote. In the end, the French have joined the U.S. in presenting a draft resolution to the Security Council. Lebanon has rejected it because it allows Israeli soldiers to remain on Lebanese soil. But that's another story. In a recent interview with Jim Lehrer, E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post joined the chorus of those who now admit that the U.S. is losing influence as a result of the Iraq War, and then referred delicately to, quote, the administration's tendency to stay away from diplomacy, end quote. Charles Freeman, a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, says that the Bush administration has used the principle of avoiding the international players it finds most objectionable in North Korea, burying any contact in the six-party talks, while counting on China to use its influence, even though our interests are not the same as Beijing's, and toward Iran, where we've subcontracted diplomacy to the Europeans because we won't talk to Tehran. Just as the invasion of Lebanon was beginning, the G8 convened its annual meeting, this time in St. Petersburg. M.K. Bhadrakumar, a retired diplomat from India, provided an interesting perspective. Quote, Putin indirectly drew attention to the U.S. isolation when he said Russia's advantage was that it did not close its doors to any parties to the Middle East conflict. Putin asserted that Russia's regular contacts with Hamas and Hezbollah actually helped to work on the G8's Middle East resolution. If this in itself wasn't an extraordinary statement, Putin rubbed it in. Iran, of course, he said, is an influential country in the region, and its interests must be respected so as to prompt it to use its influence to change the situation in Lebanon for the better, end quote. The most significant point made by Putin, in Bhadrakumar's opinion, was that the deployment of any international force in Lebanon must be on the basis of a mandate from the UN Security Council, and that Russia would participate in any such operations, but, quote, we first need to get the agreement from all the sides involved in the conflict, end quote. All in all, Bhadrakumar continued, the G8 revealed the erosion in the United States' ability to bend the world to its will. The U.S. exposed itself as having very little leverage in the Middle East situation. It also failed to get the G8 to fall in line on energy security or the Iran nuclear issue. End quote. On July 24th, at the beginning of that same week, the World Trade Organization's last opportunity to save the Doha round before Bush's special trade promotion authority to fast-track an agreement past the U.S. Congress expires came to nothing. Six key members of the World Trade Organization, the United States, the European Union, Japan, Australia, Brazil, and India, decided to bring an end to the Doha round of trade talks. IPS News reported that in India there was rare unity amongst diverse groups who believed that the decision for India to quit the Doha round was a good one. Eileen Kwa of Focus on the Global South reported that despite formal declarations of regret, outside the meeting, a few developing country delegates she spoke to could barely contain their euphoria. One delegate cautioned against prematurely labeling the round as dead. He said he would believe it, quote, only when he sees it, end quote. He was clearly delighted, but said he should contain it, quote, while I'm still here in the WTO compound, end quote. Plans are underway to try to save the Doha round this September in Brazil. Even if they're successful, numerous events are coming together now to reveal the limits of Washington's ability to become the unquestioned political and military arbiter of the globalizing world economy. While the Doha round failed to gain traction, Prime Minister Maliki of Iraq, a Shia who spent much of his life in Damascus, has not supported Israel's actions and has refused to denounce Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. This week, several hundred thousand Shias demonstrated solidarity with Hezbollah in Baghdad. Several thousand more did the same in Saudi Arabia, where demonstrations are illegal. Looking beyond Lebanon and Iraq, a recent editorial in the Baltimore Sun found that, quote, symptoms of failure are becoming harder to deny in Afghanistan. The Taliban is resurgent in the south, probably in part because of support from within Pakistan. Hundreds of civilians have died in fighting this year, including some killed in NATO bombing raids. President Hamid Karzai has told two governors to rearm their private militias, which is a big step backward, but indicative of the weakness of the Afghan police. Drought is once again afflicting the north, pushing farmers either to move or to concentrate on the one crop that doesn't need much irrigation, the opium poppy. And Mr. Karzai has reportedly given his blessing to the reincarnation of a department for the promotion of virtue and suppression of vice. The Western nations, distracted by Iraq and now Lebanon, have stumbled badly in Afghanistan. The Western presence has not significantly improved schools, roads, order, or prosperity, but it has encouraged prostitution and alcohol consumption. A week ago Thursday, Mr. Karzai attended a three-way summit of neighbors in Tajikistan. The third neighbor was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran. The U.S., the Baltimore Sun editorialist warns, could still lose in Afghanistan. End quote. None of these, neither Iraq nor Lebanon nor Afghanistan, can be claimed as a wildly successful operation. If it seems that American influence is in decline where diplomacy and trade are concerned, let's not forget that Lebanon was one of the celebrated color revolutions. In fact, just a few days ago, the Ukrainian parliament approved former President Viktor Yanukovych as prime minister. Yanukovych won 271 votes from the 450 deputies in parliament. He and his allies, who now include the president's Our Ukraine party, also dominate the country's new cabinet. However, under the Constitution, President Viktor Yushchenko has control of key ministries such as foreign affairs and defense. With the continuing trouble in Lebanon and separatist uncertainty in a number of provinces in Georgia, the policy of using pseudo-NGOs like the National Endowment for Democracy to influence elections and train activists may cost the U.S. its political dominance, too. On this side of the pond, the Organization of American States is a moderate, pro-American organization of governments in the Western Hemisphere. On July 28th, its human rights branch, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, urged the U.S. to close the Guantanamo Bay facility without delay. In 2002, shortly after detainees began to arrive, that commission granted what it calls precautionary measures in favor of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, requesting that the United States take the, quote, urgent measures necessary to have the legal status of the detainees at Guantanamo determined by a competent tribunal, end quote. Since then, the Commission has held three hearings and has reiterated the measures to the United States on four separate occasions. The Commission also amplified the measures to include possible torture or other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay, and the possible removal of detainees to jurisdictions such as Syria, where they could be subjected to torture. The U.S. has responded by saying that the Commission doesn't have jurisdiction in the matter. In February 2006, the United Nations Human Rights Commission urged the United States to close the facility without further delay. The United Nations Committee Against Torture made similar recommendations in May 2006. On June 29, 2006, in the case of Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the military commissions that the United States proposed to use to try the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, based in part upon concerns that the commissions did not satisfy the minimum protections under Common Article 3 to the Geneva Conventions. Clearly, the U.S. is not conducting the orchestra. On the contrary, it is behaving like any other partisan with some allies. The U.S. does not determine who is isolated and who is not. The U.S. does not determine who is legitimate and who is not. So much for this Monday. For more, point your browser to cjly.net/worldreport, and to contact me, email earthling@cjly.net. or snail mail, Box 767, Nelson, British Columbia, Canada, V1L5R4, Attention World Report. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Making Waves. Now for this interview of Cindy Sheehan, speaking from Jordan on August 4th, 2006.
This is Scott Verguin of KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. We have on the line from Jordan, Cindy Sheehan, co-founder of Gold Star Families for Peace and also participant Troops Homes Fast, establisher of the of Camp Casey, etc., etc. It's a privilege to speak to you, Cindy. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Scott. How's everything there in the States right now?
Well, I have to be quite honest, way too quiet.
Too quiet. Huh? It's not quiet over here. That's
no, I imagine it isn't. This is a, and I've actually been quite astonished and frustrated at how little press your, what I think is a historic trip to Jordan is. But be that as it may, hopefully that can change. But could you give us an update on how things are going there with your trip?
Well, we met with several different factions in the Iraqi parliament today and from the Iraqi parliament today, and we're just sitting there listening to them, what's going on in their country and what are the solutions to their problems.
Mm-hmm.
And we I'll be leaving tomorrow to head to Crawford, Texas. I'm going to start my vigil again on August 6th because mm-hmm. that's when I started it last year on August 6th, and they're going to some people, members of our contingent, are going to be meeting with some more Iraqi leaders tomorrow, and we're trying to work out something to get our troops out of Iraq as quickly as possible to help the Iraqi people. And of course, we also believe that our troops are being misused and abused in Iraq
mm-hmm.
by the Bush government.
How would you describe the reception you've received and the contact you've had with the Iraqi parliamentarians?
They have been very overwhelmed and touched and amazed that there are people in the United States that care so deeply about them and their country and their people that we're willing to travel so far to meet with them. But also, you know, of course they know what I've been doing in the United States, but they're not aware that most Americans are against this occupation. They don't hear about America, the American peace movement in our country, as we don't hear about what's going on in Iraq and in our country either.
Right, it kind of works both ways, doesn't it?
Exactly. They're just really touched, and they're receiving a lot of hope by meeting with us, and we're, you know, kind of listening to their stories and hearing the tragedy and the personal loss and the courage and the sacrifice that these people are making. And we're actually meeting with people who live outside the Green Zone whose lives are in danger by just meeting with us.
I think it's your most recent article on truthout.org. And in that article, mm-hmm. you mentioned a woman that you had talked to. You mentioned it as the most tragic news of the day. I think that was probably yesterday.
That was yesterday.
Could you relate that to us?
She's a doctor in one of the hospitals in Baghdad. And you know, in fact, it's a complex of four hospitals. And during the initial invasion, when the troops got to Baghdad, between April 2nd and April 9th, her hospital was seeing 100 casualties per hour. And they were operating on these people, shoving them out into the quarters when they were done with no IDs, no histories. You know, they were just basically doing, you know, this just sew them up and get them out of there. And she described it as a nightmare of amputated limbs and a sea of blood. And she is so traumatized. She was the doctor in charge of triage.
Mm-hmm.
So she would see who was the worst, get them in the operating room knowing that the people who were last on the list were going to die. You know, so she had these people's lives and deaths in her hands. And she also, the doctors in Iraq, many of them are being intimidated from going back into their hospitals by the coalition troops. And she was actually put in jail and tortured, you know, for refusing to be intimidated by the Americans. And so anyway, just a lot of stories of personal courage and sacrifice. And the people who came here today could be assassinated for their work for peace. And I just think that even though, you know, we have sacrificed a lot to get here, my son is dead, and, you know, I've made a lot of personal sacrifices. It's nothing like the people of Iraq, and we need to step up our efforts to help them.
Well, I get a very strong sense of, one, that things seem to get grimmer and grimmer in Iraq, but also there are seeds of hope still and more seeds being planted.
Well, and like I said, the meeting with us today gave them a lot of hope, and their main message to us, besides what they need for peace, is the American people need to stand in solidarity with us against the Bush government to end the occupation of Iraq. And this is what I'm going to come home and start Camp Casey again on Sunday. And we need to re-energize and recruit. And we, like I said in my article today, we need to be as ruthless for peace, doing it in peace, as they are for war.
That's right. Very good. Well, you do know that I just saw in the paper today that President Bush is heading for, maybe already is in Camp Crawford, or Camp, yeah, right, his
Camp Casey.
So-called ranch.
Camp Casey. Yes. But he's not at Camp Casey. He's
right.
In Crawford.
No, I doubt he's there, but he has gone on a 10-day vacation to Crawford.
Well, he actually cut it short to 6 days now. Every time we change our plans, he changes his plans.
Well, keep him moving. What the heck?
Yeah, we are. You know, keep him on his toes.
Okay, I would be remiss if we cut off this conversation without reminding people that several of the folks in the Troops Home Fast have broken their fast with the Jordanians, but you have decided to continue your fast, and you're on day 32. Is that right?
Exactly, and I had said that I would do it until September 21st, which is World Peace Day, and I'll continue this part of my fast, which is a liquids-only fast, until then, and on September 21st, I'm still going to fast in some way in solidarity with the Iraqi people, because no matter how hard it is, I know that at any moment I could break my fast, you know, and I could go to the market without worrying about being killed by a car bomb, but the people of Iraq don't have this option. They're suffering, and they don't have an option. And so I think that we need to sacrifice in solidarity with them to end their suffering.
Right. So you're obviously calling for as many people as possible to join you at Camp Casey?
Absolutely. Everybody's welcome, and with the purchase of my new property, we have room for everyone.
All right. All right. Well, thank you very much, Cindy, not only for your time these last few minutes, but also for your commitment. And give my best to everybody else there, please. And we wish you all the best.
It was great talking to you.
Thank you, Cindy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
I was talking to Cindy Sheehan of Gold Star Families for Peace.
Cindy Sheehan returned from Jordan and went straight to Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. On August 6th, she mentioned during a press conference that her contingency in Amman, Jordan, met with several factions of opposition parties, with the Iraq Prime Minister, and with Iraqi parliamentarians, elected officials who have peace plans and goals they want to accomplish in Iraq. And all of them said that occupation is the cause of the problem, and the occupation has to end. You're listening to Making Waves. This past week, we saw the 61st anniversaries of the U.S. nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, go by. With that in mind, we bring you this program on Confronting Nuclear Proliferation.
The following program deals with what is probably the greatest threat to our security, the continued spread of nuclear weapons. Our program features two talks which were given at a symposium sponsored by the Dane County Chapter of the United Nations Association of the USA, held in Madison, Wisconsin, on March 4, 2006. We conclude with comments by the mayor of Madison. The main speaker is Stephen Schwartz, an expert on nuclear weapons and their proliferation. For 6 years, he was executive director and publisher of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the preeminent journal on the continuing danger from nuclear weapons and the peaceful uses of nuclear technology. The title of his talk is Nuclear Hypocrisy and the Perils of Proliferation. Stephen Schwartz.
Once upon a time, not so long ago, nuclear weapons were widely considered to be unusable. Even proponents of nuclear deterrence, commonly and correctly referred to as the balance of terror, had no real desire to unleash the power of the atom. In the grand paradox of the Cold War, the very existence of nuclear weapons and the threat to use them en masse served to prevent their use. This is not to say, however, that there was no preparation or thought given to using nuclear weapons over the past six decades. To the contrary, a significant amount of war planning was done in the United States, in the Soviet Union, and now Russia, and presumably in Britain, France, China, and Israel. Scenarios were devised and refined, war games were run and rerun, targets were identified, and vast databases assembled to prepare for the use of the ultimate weapon. During every major conflict following World War II, the United States and perhaps Russia gave serious consideration to using nuclear weapons to defend its interests. Then there were the accidents and close calls when the weapons and systems we so carefully designed to protect us nearly ended up hastening our demise. Most of us are familiar with the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, rightly said to be the closest we've come to nuclear war. But how many remember or even know about the incident during the Suez Crisis in 1956? That's when the U.S. military received four separate indications that Soviet forces might be preparing to intervene on Egypt's side against British and French forces, which in the heat of the moment could have triggered the activation of NATO's nuclear strike plans against the Soviet Union. Fortunately, further investigation revealed that each indication had a completely innocent explanation, including that a fleet of unidentified aircraft flying over Turkey was, in fact, a flock of swans. Nor were such incidents confined to the Cold War. Early one morning in January 1995, Norway and the United States jointly launched a four-stage rocket to study the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, from an island off Norway's coast. As it rose above the horizon, the rocket was picked up by Russian early warning radars, which duly alerted a command center in Moscow. President Boris Yeltsin and his defense minister were both notified, and for the first time, Yeltsin's nuclear launch authorization briefcase, similar to the one nicknamed the football that accompanies the U.S. president everywhere he goes, was activated. For five or six tense minutes, confusion reigned as officials attempted to gather additional information and presumably consider ordering a retaliatory response. The Norwegian Foreign Ministry had sent a routine notification to Russia and 34 other countries in advance of the launch, but for reasons unknown, this notification never reached the on-duty officers manning and overseeing the early warning system. Thus, the research rocket was mistaken for a U.S. Trident II submarine launch missile, which made the threat of greater concern because such missiles, when launched close to Russia, can reach their targets in as little as 5 minutes. Thankfully, the nuclear button was not pushed that day. After a few more minutes, beyond the time in which Moscow could have been destroyed had the attack been real, it was clear that the trajectory of the rocket was north, away from Russia. Another crisis was averted. But now, more than 15 years after the end of the Cold War, when many people wrongly assumed that the nuclear threat had dissipated, nuclear weapons are back on our minds and on the front pages. And instead of worrying about an accidental nuclear war, we find ourselves pondering the possibility that nuclear weapons might be used deliberately by a nation or a terrorist organization. Although such use would be confined to one or perhaps several weapons and thus hardly come close to the massive worldwide devastation once possible during the Cold War, government officials and ordinary citizens alike believe that this threat is more likely, partly because terrorists seem less rational and are not bound by nuclear deterrence, and partly because it's easier to envision an attack with one weapon than an attack with many. Ask most people today what country presents the greatest nuclear threat, and the response is likely to be Iran. Our government, the news media, and many policy experts have drummed this into us. Is this true, and if so, what can be done about it? Iran does represent a threat, and we are in the midst of a crisis, but it is not a crisis about the nuclear bomb. It is a crisis about the nuclear nonproliferation regime, the international network of treaties and obligations that for more than 35 years has successfully prevented the spread of nuclear weapons. As a party to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, or NPT, Iran insists that it has the right to develop nuclear power technology for civilian purposes. And parties to the NPT do indeed have the right to nuclear power for non-military projects. But with that right comes the obligation to operate under the rules of the treaty. And Iran's illegal importation of gas centrifuge technology from the clandestine network operated by Pakistani scientist AQ Khan, its unwillingness to allow routine monitoring and inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and its decision in January to remove the IAEA's seals from its test centrifuge equipment, its on-again, off-again negotiations with Russia to abandon uranium enrichment activities in Iran and instead pursue this jointly and under appropriate safeguards at a facility in Russia, and its overheated rhetoric regarding Israel have all created serious suspicions about Iran's true intentions. My own best guess, and it's one shared by many of my colleagues in the arms control community, is that Iran is seeking to acquire at least the capability to produce nuclear weapons, but that no decision to do so has yet been made. In any case, Iran is at best, 5 to 10 years away from being able to build a nuclear weapon, and that assumes that it goes all out and encounters no serious technical obstacles along the way. At this point, Iran has only 164 test centrifuges, known as a cascade, machines which exploit the small differences in the atomic weights of different isotopes of uranium to enrich it to the level needed for use in a nuclear bomb. These were obtained from Pakistan and are currently part of a pilot enrichment facility in Natanz. The centrifuges have not operated flawlessly, and so Iran is some time away from being able to scale up its enrichment operations. Iran has indicated it intends to start industrial operations soon at its underground fuel enrichment plant. Its plans call for installing some 50,000 cascades in modules of 3,000. Should Iran pursue these plans instead of reaching agreement with Russia to conduct joint enrichment operations there, it could eventually produce approximately 500 kilograms of highly enriched uranium annually, or enough for about 25 to 30 weapons a year. Smaller scale operations are also possible. Just 1,500 centrifuges optimized to produce HEU could generate enough for about one weapon a year. An Iranian bomb does not yet exist. Neither is it inevitable. For the time being, our efforts must focus on how to stop Iran from going nuclear, not on how best to deter it if it does. The key to success is in correctly understanding the Iranian government's motivations and being willing to engage with Iran and reach a negotiated diplomatic settlement. Countries seek nuclear weapons for various reasons. In Iran's case, there are at least three. First, Iran clearly views Israel as a threat. Israel has an unacknowledged arsenal of 75 to 200 nuclear weapons, deliverable by aircraft, ballistic missile, and long-range cruise missile. Iran's leaders may view the acquisition of nuclear weapons as a means to deter Israel. It is possible that some may also seek the destruction of Israel, but any serious move in that direction would almost certainly result in attacks on Iran by Israel and perhaps the United States, factors that would weigh heavily in rational minds. Second, Iran may seek to deter or threaten the United States. The United States government, after all, has made no secret of its distaste for Iran's theocratic regime. 4 years ago, President Bush nominated Iran as a charter member of his Axis of Evil. And with more than 130,000 U.S. troops operating across the border in Iraq, and senior U.S. officials having openly talked in 2003 of taking on Iran after overthrowing Saddam Hussein's government, the Iranian leadership has reason to be concerned about U.S. intentions. Third, as with India's development of nuclear weapons, there is an element of prestige and national pride at work here. But despite the various logical reasons why Iran might want to obtain nuclear weapons, and I want to make clear that I'm not at all condoning what Iran is doing, or why it might want to provoke a fight with the West, many observers, including what I suspect is a large number of people in the United States, find Iran's motivations to be irrational, in a word, crazy. This was exemplified by an editorial cartoon that ran in the Chicago Tribune and other newspapers last month. Some of you may have seen it. The cartoon by Doug Marlette features a maniacal-looking, bearded Semitic man labeled Iran, holding a butterfly net and chasing the symbol of atomic energy, which in this context seems to refer to nuclear weapons. Running right behind him, carrying a bigger net, is an angry-looking white man whose identification tag reads Bellevue Mental Hospital. The not-so-subtle message is that Iran is literally crazy for seeking nuclear weapons. Would, I wonder, the Tribune have published the cartoon if the crazy man were labeled Israel, to pick another country just at random from the region? To digress for just a moment, there are 8 countries that have nuclear weapons: the United States, Russia, Britain, France, China, India, Israel, and Pakistan. 2 of them, the United States and Russia, together possess nearly 26,000 nuclear weapons, 95% of the world's total. More than 15 years after the end of the Cold War, some 11,500 of these weapons remain operational and on active alert, ready to be fired within minutes at their pre-programmed targets. To put this in some perspective, if the firepower contained in just the operational U.S. nuclear stockpile could somehow be segregated into Hiroshima-sized weapons, the U.S. arsenal would consist of 91,500 Hiroshima-sized bombs. If these weapons were then exploded at the rate of 1 each minute, it would take 2 months, or 63.6 days to be precise, to use up the entire U.S. stockpile. Moreover, the fiscal 2007 budget submitted to Congress last month makes clear the Bush administration is seeking the down payment on a controversial and very expensive plan to resume production of new nuclear weapons, with the goal of rebuilding the entire U.S. arsenal by 2030. How crazy is that? Iran can also now look to India as an example of how to break the rules and get away with it. After India conducted a series of provocative underground nuclear weapons tests nearly 8 years ago, 24 years after India first demonstrated a nuclear weapons capability, the Clinton administration imposed sanctions on India and on Pakistan, which responded with a test series of its own. These sanctions were short-lived, however, even as India refused to negotiate away its arsenal, which, like Pakistan's and Israel's, exists outside the legal framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Just 2 days ago, President Bush rewarded India, as well as the U.S. nuclear power industry, with a deal that tacitly accepts India's nuclear arsenal and grants it unprecedented access to nuclear technology, access that, by the way, is currently illegal, which will enable it to build even more weapons. Iranians may well be thinking to themselves, if we are patient and we play our cards right and make ourselves a valuable ally of the United States, this could be us in a decade or so. This is, to put it mildly, not a helpful message to be sending when our paramount objective should be preventing the further spread or misuse of nuclear weapons and nuclear technology. Not so long ago, nuclear weapons were considered inherently dangerous no matter who controlled them. U.S. policy concentrated on limiting the spread of such weapons regardless of who sought them. With the advent of the Bush administration, the approach has changed. Now the emphasis is on regime change to prevent nuclear weapons from falling into the wrong hands. Among the many problems with this approach is that the bad guys and the good guys can switch places with a change in government leadership. Pakistan is a case in point. For more than 20 years, successive U.S. administrations have turned a blind eye to Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, first because it was an ally against the Soviet Union following the invasion of neighboring Afghanistan, and then, after 2001, because it supported U.S. efforts to overthrow the Taliban and oust al-Qaeda. During this period, there have been 2 military coups, and more recently, Islamic extremists have targeted President Pervez Musharraf for assassination, which he has narrowly escaped at least twice. Pakistan's government may be friendly now, but what happens if Islamic extremists take over? At the very least, a lot of people will be asking why we didn't do more to eliminate Pakistan's arsenal while it was still possible. Another problem with the Bush administration's approach to nuclear nonproliferation is its disdain and even contempt for international law and diplomacy. While pledging not to resume nuclear weapons testing, the administration refuses to push for ratification of the 1996 Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, a key means of preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. It has also reduced and even tried to eliminate funding for a worldwide network of sensors to operate under the treaty and detect nuclear explosions, even extremely small ones, in the atmosphere, underground, or underwater. And we must not forget that the administration also actively impeded and denigrated the work of the International Atomic Energy Agency in the months and weeks before attacking Iraq. We now know, of course, that the IAEA inspectors were right about the complete lack of any nuclear weapons or even an active weapons development program in Iraq, something that they could have proved had they been allowed to complete their work. The irony is that what led to the discovery and dismantlement of Iraq's nuclear program in the first place was the inspection regime put in place after the first Gulf War in 1991. Most troubling of all, the administration has reneged on the commitments made by the Clinton administration to honor the letter and spirit of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty by working to further reduce and eventually eliminate the U.S. nuclear arsenal. At its most recent review of the landmark treaty in 2005 at the United Nations, the Bush administration disavowed this commitment and, even worse, undermined the ability of the delegates to achieve consensus on anything of significance. The primary reason we have just 8 nuclear-armed states instead of the 15 or 20 that President Kennedy, speculating in the early 1960s, worried might exist by 1975, is the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. That agreement convinced countries that might have gone nuclear to abstain by offering them incentives and by committing the then 5 nuclear nations to, quote, pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to the cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date and to nuclear disarmament, unquote. And while the arms race is clearly over and the number of weapons worldwide has decreased by nearly 60%, or more than 38,000, that still leaves more than 26,000 weapons. And for most people, that's 26,000 too many. The more than 180 non-nuclear signatories to the NPT have been patient, but it is clear they will not wait indefinitely for the nuclear powers to fulfill their obligations. In lieu of diplomacy and the rule of law, the administration in 2001 and 2002 implemented a series of policies and directives aimed at using coercion and military force to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. This is known as counterproliferation. Not surprisingly, the military takes the lead in this effort. There are many problems with relying on counterproliferation rather than nonproliferation. For one, the focus tends to be on eliminating weapons or weapons programs rather than preventing their acquisition in the first place. But the biggest problem today with the U.S. approach is that the administration has very little credibility on this issue. By initiating a preventative war with Iraq 3 years ago this month, on the pretext that it was or would imminently become a nuclear threat, only to subsequently discover that no such threat existed, the administration has made it significantly harder to go after countries that are known and were known in a less ambiguous way before the war to represent bigger proliferation threats. Now, when the administration starts proffering the same arguments against Iran that it made against Iraq, the international community is skeptical. It is also wary of once again using the United Nations as a staging ground for another preventive war, even one that might be more limited. The United States undercuts its own arguments in other ways. The Bush administration's Nuclear Posture Review, or NPR, completed in late 2001, requires, quote, nuclear strike capabilities, unquote, for, quote, immediate potential or unexpected contingencies, unquote, involving North Korea, Iran, Syria, Libya, Russia, and China, which was dropped from nuclear war plans in the 1980s during the Reagan administration. Immediate nuclear contingencies include, quote, a North Korean attack on South Korea or a military confrontation over the status of Taiwan, unquote. The Nuclear Posture Review also calls for developing deliberate, pre-planned, and practiced missions to attack an adversary's weapons of mass destruction facilities preemptively or in response to an attack on the United States or its allies. And it promotes the rebuilding of the nuclear weapons production complex, largely shuttered since the early 1990s, and the development of new nuclear weapons to support such planning. Such new weapons include the robust nuclear earth penetrator, a high-yield weapon concept intended to hold at risk and destroy hardened underground targets, such as arms bunkers or command and control installations, without causing significant damage, including radioactive fallout, on the surface. Addressing what's wrong with this concept would require more time than I have today, so suffice it to say that such a weapon is physically impossible. It is a fantasy dreamed up by people desperate to find new uses for increasingly irrelevant weapons, people who want to make the use of nuclear weapons more palatable, more politically acceptable, by, in effect, neutering them, taking away the very qualities that make them what they are. Congress has terminated this program as unnecessary and incompatible with U.S. policy, but it may yet reappear, perhaps in the future when the political climate is more favorable, perhaps under a different name. More troubling is the Reliable Replacement Warhead program. This project is based on the false premise that U.S. warheads will only grow more unreliable over time and that they therefore must be replaced if nuclear deterrence is to remain effective. Supporters of this program also argue that it is simply too expensive to maintain 12 different warhead types in the existing stockpile. Developing a standardized, simpler, more rugged warhead design, they say, will reduce production and maintenance costs and improve reliability. Originally proposed by Congress in late 2004, the Reliable Replacement Warhead is now part of a broader effort initiated within the Department of Energy, which is responsible for the development, production, testing, and dismantlement of U.S. nuclear weapons, to reconfigure the entire nuclear weapons complex, which last built new warheads in 1990 and last tested them in 1992. This effort is very roughly estimated to cost at least $150 billion over the next 24 years. In December 2002, the administration released the National Strategy to Combat Weapons of Mass Destruction in unclassified form. It was based on classified National Security Presidential Directive 17, signed by President Bush in May 2002. This document builds on the Nuclear Posture Review and on the administration's National Security Strategy for the United States, which was released in September of that year. Signaling an expansion of the administration's preventive preemptive war doctrine, the document declares, quote, "We must be prepared to stop rogue states and their terrorist clients before they are able to threaten or use weapons of mass destruction against the United States and our allies and friends," unquote. It continues, quote, "Given the goals of rogue states and terrorists, the United States can no longer solely rely on a reactive posture as we have in the past. We cannot let our enemies strike first," unquote. But the document goes further still in marrying a preventive preemptive strategy with nuclear weapons. And here's an extended quote. "Today's threats are far more diverse and less predictable than those of the past. As a consequence, we require new methods of deterrence. The United States will continue to make clear that it reserves the right to respond with overwhelming force, including potentially nuclear weapons, to the use of WMD against the United States, our forces abroad, and our friends and allies. Because deterrence may not succeed, and because of the potentially devastating consequences of WMD use, U.S. military forces and appropriate civilian agencies must have the capability to defend against WMD armed adversaries, including in appropriate cases through preemptive measures. This requires capabilities to detect and destroy an adversary's WMD assets before these weapons are used," unquote. A top secret appendix, which understandably was not released, authorizes attacks on Iran, Syria, North Korea, and other countries believed to be close to acquiring weapons of mass destruction or long-range missiles capable of delivering them. Attacks would be ordered to prevent the use of WMD or the transfer of WMD or WMD components into or out of such countries. Now, put yourself in the shoes of Iran, North Korea, China, or even Russia. How would you respond to a country that pledges allegiance to the concept of nuclear nonproliferation, but which shows no interest in verifiably dismantling its stockpile of 10,000 warheads and bombs, 5,300 of which remain operational, continues to maintain some 2,500 warheads on quick launch alert, ready for firing within minutes of receiving a launch order, publicly promulgates a strategy for preemptive nuclear attack and even identifies possible target countries, initiates plans to rebuild its nuclear weapons factories for the express purpose of churning out new warheads well into the 21st century, modernizes its warheads and delivery systems to increase their accuracy and effectiveness against hardened targets, something that only makes sense if the weapons are to be launched first, and is building a missile defense system, which clearly has no current or even prospective capability to defeat an attack of anything more than a handful of ballistic missiles, if that, but which could prove quite useful in mopping up an adversary's ragtag response to a U.S. first strike. If you are and wish to remain a sovereign nation, you will retain what nuclear weapons you have, or lacking any, you will seek to acquire them as quickly as possible to deter the United States from attacking you. And this is, of course, what is happening. This is not to say that U.S. actions and policies are an excuse or the sole justification for the actions of other countries. But it is clear that U.S. policies and programs are exacerbating rather than ameliorating today's dangerous trends in nuclear proliferation. But it's not just the so-called rogue states that are responding. China is considering options for augmenting its arsenal. And in the wake of the agreement with India, which will allow them to build more nuclear weapons, I'm sure they're considering that even more seriously now. Russia, hearkening back to its earlier existence as the Soviet Union, has increased its reliance on nuclear weapons, touted the development of a maneuvering warhead to defeat any U.S. defensive system, and is preparing later this year to roll out a new mobile ICBM. And in mid-January, French President Jacques Chirac announced that henceforth, France's nuclear arsenal would protect not only France itself, but also serve to guarantee certain strategic supplies necessary to the functioning of the nation. French analysts, among others, have interpreted this to mean oil, and specifically oil from Iran. But it's not all bad news. There are now fewer operational nuclear weapons worldwide than at any time since 1958. Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan all were persuaded to return to Russia the nuclear weapons they inherited after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Libya has recently abandoned its interest in developing nuclear weapons. No nation has tested nuclear weapons since 1998, despite the fact that the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty has not yet entered into force. Meanwhile, the treaty's network of sensors continues to grow in capability each year. Today, more than half of the Earth has been declared a nuclear weapons-free zone by one treaty or another, including much of the Southern Hemisphere. And Congress, after a prolonged period of somnolence and excessive deference to the executive branch, is finally exercising its constitutional authority on nuclear matters, including canceling the robust nuclear Earth penetrator, questioning the reliable replacement warhead, and raising strong objections to the just-signed U.S.-India nuclear trade agreement. So what can be done? When it comes to Iran, there are really no good choices. The key now is to unite the international community behind an effort to persuade the Iranian government that its actions are unacceptable and will not be tolerated, and that serious penalties will accrue if it continues down this path. At the same time, the international community must demonstrate that important benefits will come its way if Iran remains within the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and abandons its current uranium enrichment plans. Agreeing to Russia's proposal to host a joint uranium enrichment facility on Russian soil would be a welcome first step in that direction. Subsequent steps will obviously depend on what Iran does next, but among the options under consideration are economic and political sanctions and military attack. There's insufficient time this morning to go into all possible permutations, but the key thing to keep in mind with sanctions is that they will only be effective if they are imposed by the United Nations and not individual countries. The UN Security Council cannot allow Iran to evade its obligations under the NPT. If it does, the legitimacy and future effectiveness of that treaty will be in serious jeopardy. As for a military attack, notwithstanding all the recent news stories based on leaks or informed speculation from the United States and Israel, at least some of which seem designed to pressure Iran into modifying its behavior, it's important to understand that targeted strikes against Iran's nuclear infrastructure would only delay its program, not destroy it. The facilities are too widely dispersed, many are buried underground, and some are probably still unknown to military targeters. And a campaign of massive and sustained bombardment would seem to be out of the question. The model for such an attack is the Israeli strike against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981, at a time when Iraq was pursuing the use of plutonium for nuclear weapons. The attack did destroy the reactor before it became operational, but it was not the success it was believed to be at the time or even today, because after the attack, Saddam Hussein switched to the use of highly enriched uranium and directed that the program go underground and be carried out covertly. So successful was this approach that it was only after the first Gulf War that international inspectors discovered just how ambitious the program was and how close Iraq had come to developing a bomb. Moreover, an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities would be seen inside Iran and by the Muslim world in general as an attack on a sovereign state, rallying the Iranian people and much of the Muslim world against the attackers. Before seriously considering such an option, it is essential to consider how Iran would respond to the attack and how we would respond to their response. If the answers to these questions don't show things getting better following the attack, it's time to try another approach. Then there's the effort by the United States, announced recently by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, to spend $75 million to promote internal opposition to Iran's existing government. Apart from the irony that the world's self-appointed promoter of democracy would support, much less publicly announce, an effort to destabilize a democratically elected government, this paltry program seems doomed to failure because it will most likely delegitimize and thus hamper internal Iranian dissent, while at the same time providing the Iranian government ample reason to harden its position and accelerate its nuclear program. A better use of the State Department's time and money, our money really, would be to use the United Nations to rally the world behind the cause of nonproliferation, demonstrating that this is not just a regional problem, but a global one. Then we could lead the way to strengthening the NPT, starting with renewing our commitment to nuclear disarmament, and then moving on to close the loopholes in the treaty that allow parties to legally acquire everything necessary to produce nuclear weapons, and then withdraw with no penalty from the treaty to develop such weapons free from the treaty's restrictions. We should also abandon counterproliferation as our primary means of combating the spread of nuclear weapons and nuclear technology. Taking nonproliferation seriously means expanding and fully funding efforts like the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, which since the early 1990s has helped Russia to secure sizable quantities of nuclear weapons materials and destroy nuclear delivery systems like ICBMs, bomber aircraft, and submarines, not to mention sealing up all of their nuclear test holes at their Kazakhstan nuclear test site. Yet an influential 2004 Harvard study found less progress in this program in the years following 9/11 than in the years preceding it. The government should also heed the recommendations of a bipartisan 2001 task force, which recommended spending $30 billion over 10 years, or $3 billion a year, to eradicate the threat posed by unsecured or poorly secured nuclear weapons and weapons materials. Yet 5 years later, annual spending continues to be just over $1 billion. Contrast that with the almost $10 billion we're going to spend on missile defense this year. The United States should also work with Israel and the other nations of the Middle East to establish a nuclear weapon-free zone in the region. This is clearly a long-term objective, but even agreeing to it as an objective and beginning negotiations toward that end could go a long way toward resolving some of the current dilemmas. As part of this process, Israel would have to acknowledge the existence of its nuclear stockpile. The American people and the Congress which represents them must demand a reversal of the Bush administration's failed and inconsistent approach to nuclear proliferation. We cannot pick and choose whose nuclear weapons are tolerable and whose are not and expect any degree of success or safety. Neither can we have a successful policy by confronting proliferation one country at a time. We need a policy that treats countries equally and fairly. Lastly, as the undisputed sole superpower and the only country ever to use nuclear weapons, the United States has a unique responsibility when it comes to nuclear nonproliferation. We also have more to lose if the nonproliferation regime collapses or is allowed to deteriorate to such a point that it becomes meaningless. Simply put, we must lead by example. If we, with our vastly superior conventional capabilities and inherent geographic advantages, insist on retaining and modernizing the nuclear arsenal well into the 21st century and using it, among other things, to target those countries that would challenge us, other countries will naturally respond in kind. When combined with a systematic effort to devalue international agreements that constrain the spread of nuclear weapons, this is a recipe for nuclear disaster. If, on the other hand, we abandon our six-decade embrace of the bomb, devalue nuclear weapons as instruments of military and diplomatic policy, and demonstrate that such weapons actually contribute to instability and insecurity, we will be doing ourselves and the world a tremendous favor. Thank you.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.